This is the Big E Sports Show on SB Nation Radio.
Final second. It's over. It's over. Cleveland is a city of champions once again. The Cavaliers are NBA champions.
Here's your host, 6'1", former Oklahoma Sooner basketball player, Alyssa Walker-Campbell.
Hey, we are back at SB Nation Radio, the Big E Sports Show. I am Alyssa Walker-Campbell. So glad you made it to Point to join us on this Friday night. Yep, we're already in hour number two. And guess what? Who's going to help us kick off hour two? That is our executive producer, Ron Culver. Lots to dive into. But I'll tell you what I want to get into. You know, Lee Steinberg was just on the show. We were talking about the Ezekiel Elliott situation, the suspension, 6 games, no pay.
Way too much.
Do you agree or disagree?
Way too much. The 6 games
wow.
is way too much. Listen, I'm not saying...
there's been a lot of transgressions. This young guy, he needs to learn his lessons, don't you think?
I agree that he's like a kid who just got a gigantic wallet and doesn't know what to do with it and is just burning holes everywhere he goes. But I don't. I think it is ill-sighted for the NFL to be handing out such significant punishments when they themselves don't have all the facts. And when they themselves, basically, we all know that the only reason why they're doing this is because they're trying to make up for past transgressions.
Oh, yeah, Greg Hardy and Ray Rice.
Right.
They've got to take a strong stand.
But Ezekiel hasn't been charged with anything, has not been criminally charged with anything at all. And he's being punished more severely than Josh Brown was punished. And he admitted to domestic violence.
Yeah, but as Lee was talking about in hour number one, you know, they did a 13-month investigation. They've got to have been able to find something there, right?
Yeah, they had to have, but, I mean, apparently they didn't have... They were lied to by this ex-girlfriend of Ezekiel Elliott,
right,
where she said, no, I wasn't trying to blackmail him. And then recently all these text messages came out that she, in fact, was trying to blackmail him. I'm wondering if that's going to have any effect on Ezekiel Elliott's appeal.
Well, and I have to wonder, too, in that appeal, how much they will modify that, if they will at all.
I hope they do. I mean, if they knock it down to 2 games, I think that'll be fine. I think everyone's like, all right, you know, 2 games, you know, Ezekiel, learn your lesson. Hopefully this is it, so your name doesn't become, you know, hopefully you're more like some of the other more positive role model running backs in the league, like, say, a David Johnson or a Melvin Gordon or Todd Gurley. They're just out there. They're trying to hustle. They're trying to become one of the greats. Ezekiel Elliott, you proved last year that you can be one of the greats. Now let's try to keep that off the field situations quiet.
Good way to get hour number two started right here at SB Nation Radio, the Big E Sports Show, with our executive producer, and that is Ron Culver. Stick around. We got much more coming your way in hour number two right after this quick timeout.
This is the Big E Sports Show on SB Nation Radio. Here's your host, Alyssa Walker-Campbell.
Welcome back to SB Nation Radio and the Big E Sports Show. I am Alyssa Walker-Campbell, and our college football preview, it continues. And right now, we are going to narrow our focus on the Notre Dame Fighting Irish, a team that finished last year. Oh, my. They were 4-8, and they are certainly trying to right the ship and get back to their winning ways. Expectations always very, very high, and we are so delighted to have back with us Notre Dame great, a former standout for the Fighting Irish. He was part of a national championship under their great coach, Ara Parsegian, who recently passed away. The great Frank Pomerico. Hello, Frank. It's been way too long.
Yes, it has, and I'm glad to be with you. Anytime I get towards the football season, uh-huh, I get a boost of energy. It's like having 5 or 6 cups of coffee a day. I'm ready to go.
Absolutely. Well, I can't wait to talk about your Fighting Irish, but right now, I want to honor the legendary and late Notre Dame coach that you had the opportunity to play for in Ara Parsegian. College football lost one of its great coaches, a beloved member of the Notre Dame family, and a very, very good man. How will you always remember him?
Well, I remember somebody I could always go to if I had a problem. He was really kind of a father figure. He wasn't your friend. He was your coach. But also, you always felt secure around him that you can go ask him anything that you needed to, and he would give you a good, honest answer. He wasn't somebody that volunteered that much information to you if you didn't ask him. But if you did ask him, he'd help you out as much as he can. But also, the way he ran his program, I mean, everybody was filled with pride, with discipline, and with loyalty. And when you have those factors involved, you have that family-type atmosphere, and we felt a bond, that even we feel a bond with the guys that played with him at Northwestern, mm-hmm, and also Miami of Ohio. there was that special bond between all of us. When I asked if they would respond as far as when I was writing the book, they couldn't help enough. And it was really refreshing to hear that.
Well, Eric Parseghian, he had so many accomplishments as a head coach, and I know you talked about in the book, of course, winning those national championships in 66 and 73. Talk to us about how was he able to bring out the best in his players on and off the field?
Well, I think one of the things is that you wanted to be around this fella. He was somebody that exuded confidence. He was so hardworking and prepared. And he was fair. And I think anytime you're fair with people, you get a tremendous amount of loyalty back. So when you were playing, it wasn't like you were playing out of fear. You were playing because you wanted to make this fella proud of you. And it's a similar situation that you might have with a parent. But that's why there was such a great feeling of bonding with all the players to Era. I mean, he was a great motivator. He talked to us much more than just about football. He talked to us about life, about character, about giving your best at all times and never quitting. So those are kind of the highlights of some of the things he always used to talk to us about.
What was his motivation style approach? How did he present things in terms of the game plan?
Well, I think as far as the game plan, he would always look for the weak points in the opposition. Now, a lot of times we would have superior, stronger guys to play against a team, but he would always still like to look for the soft spot in the other team and exploit it as much as we possibly could, using tactics where you didn't know if it was going left or right, you didn't know if it was going to be a pass or if it was going to be a run. And a lot of times he had that in the quarterback's hands. And the best quarterback general we had was Tommy Clements, who was the assistant head coach for the Green Bay Packers for the last 5 or 6 years. But he was the epitome of what Era wanted, and he really was Era on the field. So that's why we were so successful in 73 and 74.
We are celebrating the late and great Era Parseghian and his time at Notre Dame. What an amazing man. Visiting with Frank Pomerico, former Notre Dame standout, tonight at SB Nation Radio, the Big East Sports Show. And Frank, one of the reasons we extended this invitation is, that's right, college football season is here. You were talking about being amped up, fired up about the upcoming season. So is Notre Dame, are they going to win more than 4 games? Come on.
You know, I think so. I think last year there was a crumbling of a confidence in the defense, especially. I think offensively they had a good production out of people like Kaiser, Deshaun Kaiser,
yeah,
and Adams. He almost ran for 1,000 yards last year. St. Brown is a great receiver. So, you know, we have some really good talent. I think it's going to be a matter of focusing the ship and getting right back on track. We have 2 new coordinators, Chip Long and Mike Elko, on defense, Chip Long on offense. Chip Long came from Memphis State. And we have a new strength coach named Ballas. And the thing is about the strength coach is he's somebody that's working with the players every day, 365 days a year. So he really gets a good pulse on the kids, and it's a very important position. So we seem to think that everything is going to be going in the right direction, and we're going to have some new techniques to work on, but yet I think we have the talent to compete with our schedule.
Well, Notre Dame, as you were just talking about, they've got 2 new coordinators, a new special teams coach, new strength coach, and here Brian Kelly, he is back for his 8th season. Can you give us a sense in terms of, you know, is he on the hot seat? How much pressure does Brian Kelly have on him coming into this season?
Well, I think there's, when you're at Notre Dame, you're on the hot seat all the time. You have to, not only do you have to beat teams, but you have to beat them by X amount of touchdowns and points. And I think a lot of the pressure comes from within. Brian Kelly is a good football coach. He is somebody that I think really cares about the program and really cares about his players. So I think it's a situation where he wants to get the best out of his kids. He wants to get the best out of his coaches and try to stay at Notre Dame as long as he possibly can. So is he on the hot seat? I think every year he's on the hot seat. Is he going to have a successful year? I think he is. I think that's going to be reversed. There's going to be at least an 8-4 season and probably invited to a maybe a second-tier bowl. But that's okay. Hopefully we're surprised they're going to be playing in the Final Four.
Former Notre Dame standout Frank Pomerico back with us at SB Nation Radio, the Big E Sports Show. When Frank's on the show, that means college football, it is here. And Frank, you've had a lot of time to marinate and kind of reflect on, you know, how things transpired at the end of the 2016 season. Why did the Fighting Irish, why did they struggle so much last year?
Well, I think, again, I think there was an erosion of some of the things that keep a team together. When I say that, I mean, that starts from maybe the conditioning aspect of it. I think there was some real criticism of the defensive coordinator last year, and halfway through the season, he was let go. So that causes confusion right away. There were some injuries that happened. That happens on every team, though. And, again, I think what you're looking at, when you're looking at players and coaches that are playing against Notre Dame, they are. It's a kind of a mini bowl game for them. When they come into Notre Dame Stadium, they want to get a piece of Notre Dame tradition, and they can say, "Hey, we beat Notre Dame." Like when you look at Navy last year, clearly they do not have the same kind of talent as Notre Dame does. But I tell you, they were fighting in the trenches all the way to the end of the game. They got the ball back with 7 minutes and 30 seconds to go.
Wow.
They held the ball the whole time, so they didn't give Notre Dame an opportunity to get back on the field. That is good coaching, and that is good play by Navy. But Notre Dame should have been able to stop them, but they couldn't. So I think there's going to be renewed confidence, and I think there's going to be a fresh set of strategy from the defensive end as well as on the offensive end.
Okay, Frank, we only have time for one more question. Just tell us about the layout of the schedule. There'll be 80,000 fans ready to watch their Fighting Irish at home when they open up the season September 2nd against Temple.
Well, the stadium is spectacular. They just put $500 million into the stadium.
Wow.
Didn't add that many more seats to it, but we have a new scoreboard, and I'm happy to say and proud to say the first thing they put on that was ERA, A-R-A.
Yeah.
And that was really a great tribute to ERA. But I think in playing Temple, who was 10-3 last year, they're going to give Notre Dame all they can take. But I think Notre Dame's going to come out on top.
You've been listening to Frank Pomerico, former Notre Dame standout, and we were celebrating his former coach, Ara Parseghian, just amazing, and tonight at SB Nation Radio and the Big E Sports Show. Thank you so much, Frank.
My pleasure. I was very happy to be with you today.
Absolutely. Stick around. Much more coming your way right here, the fastest 2 hours in radio at SB Nation Radio.
This is the Big E Sports Show on SB Nation Radio. Here's your host, Alyssa Walker-Campbell.
Hey, welcome back to SB Nation Radio and the Big E Sports Show. As promised, our college football preview continues as we shine the spotlight now on the Texas Longhorns. They open up their season September 2nd against Maryland. So we're going to head to Austin and visit with our good friend Steve Habel, who writes for Horns Illustrated and also for the Texas Golf Insider. Always good to have you back with us at SB Nation Radio. Good evening, Steve.
Hey, thanks for having me on. It's always a pleasure.
Well, the expectations are big time as Tom Herman brings in his up-tempo pro-style offense to Austin. How are things coming along so far here as we get ready to quickly wrap up the month of August?
Well, it's been a good spring camp so far for Texas. There have been some physical situations going on. I mean, Herman is a physical coach, and he expects his teams to play physical and tough, even in practice. And he that's taken its toll a little bit injury-wise, but I think that the kids have bought in to what he's trying to sell. Enthusiasm is high here. Expectations are always high in Austin, as you well know. And it's going to be a turnaround season for Texas. We all believe that here.
It's interesting you talk about how physical the practices have been, because from what I understand, head coach Tom Herman, he voiced his displeasure about the defensive lineman's conditioning level. So what specifically has he done to take it up and ratchet up to the next level?
Well, the team just went super physical in the offseason on the weight room and in offseason practice to get themselves in shape. They lost a huge amount of what they've just water weight and body weight that they had in the past, and they've picked up a lot of strength. He gave us some numbers a couple weeks ago that weren't too much to look at, just because, I mean, they didn't really have a point of reference, but the whole point was that he was talking about how much stronger he felt his team was. Just core strength and being able to stay on the field, play at the optimum level late in games. You know, Texas lost, you know, three games by less than 5 points last year. And, you know, that they might have won if they would have been in better shape. So I think he's putting a huge emphasis on that this year, and the kids have really responded.
Steve Havel is the senior editor with Horns Illustrated. Glad you're with us tonight at SB Nation Radio, the Big E Sports Show. I am Elissa Walker-Campbell as we shine the spotlight on the Texas Longhorns. So, Steve, I know that you have opportunities to interact with some of the players. Have they given some feedback? Have they provided some feedback in terms of how intense the practices are and really just the change? You know, first-year head coach Tom Herman at Texas, how different is it than Charlie Strong's program?
Well, they've given us a lot of talk about, you know, accountability. You know, of course, we hear that from every team, but it's just a matter of that there's a hunger here, Alyssa, that Herman has seen this stoke, the fire that hasn't been lit here the last couple of years, and all the players are tired of losing at Texas, and they've had three consecutive losing seasons. It's hard to believe that Texas has only had three winning seasons. Since they went to the national championship game in 2009 against against Alabama, it's hard to even think about that after all the years they've had won 10 games per year for all those years in a row. So that just the fervor that the players have to make that change has been the real difference maker here in Austin. Now, that doesn't mean that they're going to win all their games. It doesn't mean that they're going to win even 10 games or maybe even not 9 because, you know, the Big 12 is a tough league, and everybody's always out to get Texas. So I think a bowl game and maybe a 7-win regular season is a pretty high expectation for Texas at this point.
Have you been able to get a sense of perhaps what's going to be the biggest challenge for the Longhorns this season?
Defense has always got to be ranked number one with me. You know, they've been so poor defensively the last 3 years. Under Strong, who is a defensive coach, you know, you got to stop people to win games. I mean, Big 12 is an offensive league. Everybody knows that. But you still got to make plays on defense. You know, that's the bottom line. Defense wins games. And Texas has not played well defensively. Todd Orlando, Texas' new defensive coordinator, is really an aggressive coach as far as a game caller. He's going to blitz from all different situations. I think the kids like that. They like the fact that they're going to be able to play really hard and be unpredictable. How Texas plays on the defensive side of the ball is how far they'll get carried this year.
Okay, since we are talking about defense, I've heard a lot about the top newcomer perhaps could be linebacker Gary Johnson, junior college transfer from Dodge City, Kansas Community College. I understand that he had a previous commitment to Alabama. Is he an instant impact type of player? What kind of impact can he make?
Well, he's still getting himself in shape here. He will make an impact before the season's over. He's a little bit undersized, about 6'1", maybe 220 right now. He came in about 212. But he's a guy who can run the field and hit sideline to sideline. You know, he won his 100-meter dash in Alabama as a high school senior without even starting blocks. He ran a 10.54.
Wow. 10.54. Oh, my gosh. That's exciting.
That big, it was a 200-pounder. I mean, that tells you what kind of speed he has. So I think Texas is very excited about having him and how he fits into the field, you know, into the plan at this point with Texas returning starters on the field. We'll have to see it. But I think he will make a huge impact before the end of the year.
Hey, Steve Havel, back with us at SB Nation Radio, the next generation of sports radio and the Big E Sports Show. I am Elissa Walker-Campbell as we continue a preseason breakdown. That's right, for the Texas Longhorns, their schedule will get underway here shortly, September the 2nd against Maryland. We've been talking a lot about Texas's defense, the expectations for that. But what about offensively? Because a historic freshman season for now sophomore quarterback in Shane Buechel. Is he the designated starter? Tell us a little bit about as far as how he looks here in the month of August.
Well, Buechel's been good in the offseason. He's not the designated starter yet. Herman is not going to announce the starter until probably next week. But Buechel has taken over the leadership role. He's been a little bit more vocal. Now, he's a little guy. He's not that big and strong.
Yeah, that's right.
He can throw the ball. He can get it out of his hand. It's just a matter of how he reacts to getting hit sometimes. And last year, that didn't happen very well for him. I think that Buechel is going to eventually be the starter here. I mean, sure, he'll start the season in that role. And how he plays has got a big part of how Texas runs on offense, especially the fact that they've been a little banged up in running back, and you know, those two parts really have to work together.
What kind of depth does Texas have at running back? What does Texas have there?
Well, you know, they had hoped to get the season with Chris Warren III, who was a second part of that hammerhead lineup at running back they had starting last year. But Warren got hurt last year, four games into the season, and then he missed the rest of the year. And he's been back and forth with injuries. He's a big kid. He's a 6'3", 250-pounder right. that can really run. But last year he had a knee injury. He had a hamstring injury in the spring. He got the mumps in July. Wow. And was out for a couple weeks of preseason. And just this week he was out a couple games with some concussion-like situation. But he's back at practice. His durability is a big key to this team because they've got four or five other running backs, including Kyle Porter, who played a lot last year. But he's been hurt, too. I think that they really need that position to take some of the pressure off of Bouchel to help him run the offense.
And I think for the Longhorns, too, correct me if I'm wrong, Steve, the special teams, you guys needed a lot of work. Is that right?
Yeah, the teams were blocking a lot of kicks against Texas last year, and I don't think that's going to happen with Herman this year. Herman has already talked about how he's going to he expects his starters on both sides of the ball, his skilled player starters, to play on special teams because it's such a big part of this, you know, a turnaround type situation here. I'd like to see some returns as well. I mean, Texas has a lot of fast kids that can catch the ball and run with it if they get the chance. So, I think special teams is always the X factor when you go into a season like this.
And a ton of excitement coming into the 2017 college football season. Right now we are zeroing in on the Texas Longhorns going one-on-one. Horns Illustrated's very own. That is Steve Habel. He is back with us at SB Nation. So give us a breakdown on the schedule. I mentioned here in the open, the season starts in with Maryland, and then you guys will be packing your bags and heading out to USC September 16th. And oh my goodness, they look like they are up to be a national contender this year.
Yeah, USC is going to be a tough test for anybody, especially Texas. I mean, Texas, we're thinking that Texas should be able to win the first two games against Maryland and San Jose State. And then they got to go to the Coliseum, which will be interesting. And Texas hasn't played in the Coliseum in probably 40 years, and they haven't played USC since the Vince Young game in the Rose Bowl.
So,
but, you know, Herman has a great record. I think he's 6-0 against teams that are ranked in the top 10 when he's coached, so he knows how to get teams ready. But you know, you got to look past that game. I mean, Texas, even if Texas loses that game, and then they come into a stretch of the conference where they have to go to Iowa State on a Thursday night, they come back and they host Kansas State here in Austin, and then they have like a juggernaut in October where they have to go to Dallas against OU, then they have come back home for Oklahoma State, then they have back-to-back road games against TCU and Baylor. So it's that October schedule will know exactly how far Texas is going to go this year.
In your mind, Steve, who is the top team within the Big 12 Conference? You had just mentioned Oklahoma, but Oklahoma State, Mike Gundy, I mean, his guys are locked and loaded. They got a lot of offensive power, too.
I have predicted that Oklahoma State will be the team to beat this year. I mean, Oklahoma's great, but I think that Oklahoma State has got more weapons. You know, they've got guys that came back to play with each other and thought this could be a special season. Gundy is a great coach. I think he's super underrated. I saw him in the Alamo Bowl last year against a really good Colorado team, and they just dismantled them with the talent they have. So I've actually predicted that Mason Rudolph will be in the Heisman Trophy race more than Baker Mayfield. You know, they've got skill position players everywhere, like Oklahoma State always does. So that, to me, is the team to beat.
Always a true pleasure when Steve Habel is with us. Horns Illustrated, you can also check him out. Texas Golf Insider, some good stuff there. Thank you so much, Steve. We appreciate you joining us on this weekend. Can't wait to the start of the college football season.
Thanks for having me, Alyssa. Take care.
Absolutely. Stick around. Much more coming your way right here at SB Nation Radio and the Big E Sports Show.
This is the Big E Sports Show on SB Nation Radio. Here's your host, Alyssa Walker-Campbell.
Hey, welcome back to the next generation of sports radio at SB Nation Radio, the Big E Sports Show. Indeed, it is time. We're going to go inside the ropes with our weekly golf segment. We are so delighted to welcome back after a week off right here at SB Nation, and that is former PGA Tour player and author Larry Miller. Good evening, Larry.
Great. Good evening. Great to be back. We have lots to talk about.
Absolutely. So let's get right into our next segment and start off our conversation with a recap of the PGA Championship. How about the good, the bad, and the ugly, the winners and losers from day four at Quail Hollow? All I can say is let's start with the good news. What a performance by Justin Thomas to capture his first major championship.
Yeah, that's the good news. He's a good guy. He's a great player who's been just ready for a major, and it's not going to be the last one. And it's he's pretty amazing athlete for a guy his size. That he's one of the longest hitters on the PGA Tour, and you know he's 150 pounds and slight of build. And but when you watch him swing and the way he turns his body with the flexibility. You know, it's pretty amazing. But anyway, that is the good. That is the good news. We had a great winner, yet another fine person, as well as a great player.
Absolutely. Hey, Larry Miller back with us at SB Nation Radio, the Big E Sports Show. You know, Larry, also, I think a very strong performance by Ricky Fowler, who made four consecutive birdies, 12 through 15, and flirted with being a serious contender.
He's been close, and it seems like, you know, there's always one little thing, a double bogey like he had or a couple of missed putts. I mean, he's very close to winning, and his turn is coming. He's too good of a player not to cash in on one of those majors, but he's going to have to wait till next year.
You know, it's interesting because many times in our program you talk about, Larry, how doubles, you know, triple bogeys, it'll jack up your scorecard and get you out of contention. And I think of, you know, Ricky on day one in that first round, he had that triple bogey on the fifth hole. And, you know, he had to be kicking himself because, you know, that definitely, you know, factored in.
Yeah, bogeys don't hurt you. You know, doubles and triples and worse do because bogeys, you know, one birdie makes up for it. And these guys make so many birdies, they hit it so far, and they have so many short irons and wedges into greens, and they can reach par fives, they're going to get birdies. So if you limit your mistakes to just bogeys, it's easy to recover from. But when you make a double or triple, now you're under the gun, and it adds to the pressure because now you know that you need two or three birdies just to catch up and get even. So that's a score record, is to make worse than bogey. I always, you know, when I'm working with a player, I always try to get them to minimize the damage. If you get in trouble, you know, try to get bogey out of it if you can, and try to limit those big numbers.
You know, when I think about Ricky Fowler's career, I mean, he has had so many strong performances. How do you think he's not getting frustrated, you know, with his, you know, having that breakthrough win and winning a major?
I think he is at the point of frustration because he's been, you know, so close, and he's, seems like in these majors, he's always right up near the top, and then something happens, you know, some little thing happens every time to put an end to it, to his run. So I would think he's beginning to get a little frustrated, he's too good a player, you know, not to get through, and he's going to have, you know, he's young, he's going to have so many more chances in majors if he just realizes that and starts working more in course management and limiting those mistakes to bogeys, he's going to win one soon.
Well, speaking of frustration, we got to talk about in the PGA Championship the gamble that did not pay off, and that is Jason Day. He defended his third round, you know, just his shot selection at the PGA Championship. But what was your reaction when you saw that, you know, he attempted to go for it, you know, behind the tree and wrap it around?
Well, we talked about the good, and we've got the bad and ugly to talk about, and it just so happens the bad and the ugly are the same thing. And it was Jason Day's debacle there. You know, Jason Day had the shot that he tried to play, there was no possible positive outcome for that shot. It was not possible. Well, you know, nothing's impossible. He could have hit the ball into the middle of a tree, and it hits a branch and bounces in the fairway. I mean, you know, one in a million. But there really was no positive outcome possible. And, you know, his caddy, I would have to think, no one has come out and said it, but I would have to believe that his caddy made some attempt, even if it was a minor or small attempt, to get him to chip the ball back into the fairway. He would have made maybe a par. He would have had a short iron to the green or wedge if he chipped out, at least a short iron. And he may have gotten it up and down for par. At the worst, he would have made bogey. He would have been in the fairway with a good lie with a short iron. The shot that he tried to play, it was impossible. They had no positive possible outcome for that shot. And I guess that my guess is that I have a theory about it. And, you know, mm-hmm. if you remember back to the U.S. Open at Chambers Bay,
okay.
Jason Day had that attack of vertigo on the last hole when
yeah.
he kind of collapsed and couldn't stand up. And they waited a while and finally got him up, and he struggled to finish the last hole. Well, you know, this round in the PGA was almost 6 hours long. It was over 5.5 hours long, and it was hot. Fatigue had to be setting in. I think it was either some small minor form of that vertigo that he had, or it was just real bad fatigue that set in that clouded his thinking, because his thinking had to be very clouded to try that shot. Even Nick Faldo on the air said that it's the worst decision he's ever seen a professional make, and that's pretty strong. But it was. It was just no way that he could do anything with that shot. So I think something happened neurologically there, whether it was a vertigo attack or whether it was fatigue, extreme fatigue, dehydration, because, you know, when that happens, your thinking gets a little fuzzy, and you can make mistakes you don't normally make. So I think that's what happened. But it probably cost him a chance to win the golf tournament. If he makes par in that hole, he's probably in a playoff.
You know, that's interesting perspective when we talk about Jason Day, because it was surprising that he would make this type of decision being a six-time major champion. Now, when he was asked about it, you know, he said he was attempting to hit a low hook, but he slipped a little bit. And he said 9 times out of 10 that he could hit that shot. Do you agree?
No. The low hook, he had to go under some branches, yes. He had to keep it low. He would have had to hook the ball 60 yards.
It was an aggressive move, yeah.
But then they had trees beyond the low branches. There was no way. He would have had to start the ball with the hospitality tents, which are 80 yards to the right of the green, and hook it back. That's not possible. You can't hook a ball that far, and especially when you have no follow-through. He was going to hit the tree, and he did hit the tree with his club after he made impact with the ball. But when you have that kind of situation, you always flinch and you hold back the release. And there's just no way he could hook the ball that far. Even with a full release and a full swing, he couldn't hook it that far. So it was just all around a crazy bad decision. And I think it was brought on by some sort of fatigue or something physical that affected his thinking.
You're listening to the voice of Larry Miller. We are Inside the Ropes tonight at SB Nation Radio, the Big E Sports Show. Always love to hear from all of our audience. You can give us a tweet at E Radio Sports, or always email the show at info@eradiosports.com. And perhaps you're just tuning in. You can always go back and listen to each and every one of our very special interviews, our exclusive interviews at SB Nation at podcastarena.com. Podcastarena.com. Okay, so as we kind of do a recap of Jason Day, his decision at the PGA Championship. I want to talk some more, Larry, and you had briefly mentioned this, you know, the role of the caddy. What could he have done? Should he have been more aggressive and stepped in? Should he have, you know, given him a wedge and just told him, go ahead and just punch it out?
In that situation, absolutely. I would have given my player the wedge, and I would have walked away with the golf bag.
Right.
And put him on the spot and make him think and make him slow down and think. You know, just like Jordan Spieth did when he saved that great bogey there in the British Open, mm-hmm. where he slowed things down and gave himself time to think it out and find a way. Jason Day, you know, needed to slow down and think about it or have someone think for him. But the caddy absolutely, in that situation, should have stepped in. You know, the player is always the captain, the boss, and has the final say, and the ultimate decision is his. There are situations where the caddy needs to step in. You know, famously, Phil Mickelson, he always gave Bones one veto per year.
Okay, he did.
he said, you've got one veto per year. So there was a kind of a funny story where they were in the British Open, and Phil was going to try this crazy shot, you know, and Bones stepped in and said, I'm going to use my veto. And Phil tells him, yeah, he says, that doesn't, that's only domestically. It doesn't count internationally.
Well, you know, and one of the things that you talk a lot about to Larry on our program is, you know, safety first, right?
Yeah, safety first. That, you know, that I'll tell you where that really came from
okay,
Jack Nicklaus and Ben Hogan. Jack Nicklaus won more tournaments by letting other people mess up. And he would always play the percentages and give himself a little margin for error. And he was very famous for playing, you know, playing safety first around the golf course. And it's so important because, and Hogan did the same thing. You have to take all steps possible to take any trouble out of play as best you can. Because as we said before, doubles and triples are what ruin tournament rounds. And so you make those when you bring trouble into play and consequently get in trouble. So you have to, the first priority is to take the trouble out of play, whether it's a bunker or water hazard or out of bounds, and safety first. And always try to give yourself a good lie in the fairway in the short grass. That's how you can score and hit approach shots close to the hole. And talking a little bit more about the caddy-player relationship, there's so many dynamics involved there. You know, if we talked about the ladies' tour, how the caddies are so much more involved with the player. Yeah. They line up shots behind them and they move away before they swing, line up putts. They're a lot more involved than the male caddies are. The guys on the PGA Tour, there's a couple of them that interact, you know, all the time, like Jordan Spieth. And Phil did with Bones. They're constantly chattering and talking about things. But for the most part, if you watch the men pros, there's not that much interaction. The caddy really is there to get the yardages and the pin locations and yardages. But as far as shot selection and all that, that's left up to the player. But not so on the LPGA. They're much more involved. And that probably explains why the caddy carousel, as we say, is more evident on the ladies' tour, where you know you're hiring and firing caddies much more frequently than on the men's tour, because the caddies are more involved, and so they're more apt to be blamed for mistakes.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the women's tour, but as far as with the men, with the PGA, how much has that relationship changed between caddy and player since you were a player and when you were on the tour and in the PGA, Larry?
Oh, it tremendously.
Okay, how so?
Well, when I played, you know, first of all, there were no range finders, you know, and you had 150-yard bushes on some courses.
Yeah.
And the player was much more responsible for club selection then. And the caddies back then, without the range finders, they would literally walk the course in the mornings before the player would play his round. They'd walk all 18 holes with one of those wheels that you push. You know, and it measures yardage. It's a measuring wheel. That's how they got their yardage.
Wow.
And they would chart the golf course for the player. But then once he teed off, it was just totally up to the player. He'd have his yardages, and he'd make all the decisions. And the caddy was there, really, to keep the clubs clean and carry the bag and keep the towel wet and his mouth shut. That's what we used to say. That was the rule. You know, keep the towel wet and keep your mouth shut. Changed now. Now it's much more of a partnership.
We are going one-on-one with Larry Miller as we are inside the ropes. The PGA news and notes will continue after this quick commercial break.
This is the Big E Sports Show on SB Nation Radio. Here's your host, Alyssa Walker-Campbell.
Hey, welcome back to SB Nation Radio, the Big E Sports Show. I'm Alyssa Walker-Campbell, and we are going to pick up right where we left off with Larry Miller, PGA professional, as we are inside the ropes. He is a life member of the PGA of America and former PGA Tour player. He is the author of four books, one including What He Never Told the World. We're talking about Ben Hogan's Secret Fundamental. And all of our listeners, they love when you're on the program. Why don't you provide this weekend, get everybody ready. It's only 108 here in Houston, or it feels like it out on the course. Give us some good putting tips. What can they take away going into the weekend?
You know, in my first book, I wrote the book. It was all about the golf swing, and I got to the end of the book, and I said, you know, I've got to put something about putting in this book to make it complete, but what am I going to put in there?
Yeah.
Because everybody, you know, it's so unique and so individual, putting styles and grips and everything else. So what I figured, you know, you have to maximize your chances to make putts. It's not an exact science. You can hit you can read the putt perfectly and hit it perfectly with a perfect stroke, and a little bug can crawl across and knock the ball offline, or an irregularity in the green can do it. So a lot of things can happen. But if you take steps to maximize your chances of making putts, you can simply make more putts. And the way you do that, there's two things, okay? Most amateurs either come up short or miss on the low side.
Yeah.
So my advice to the amateurs out there with their putting is to reach the hole with your putts. It's pretty obvious. If it doesn't reach, it won't go in. But fact is, most amateurs come up short. And a lot of times by coming up short, the ball will break off to the low side, and you'll miss on the low side. And that's why probably 80% of amateurs miss putts on the low side of the cup. So my advice is to concentrate on reaching the hole and play a little more break than you think you should.
Yeah.
Because you get most of the time you're going to miss on the low side. If you play a little bit more break, you're going to maximize your chances of making putts. So that's the best advice I can give in putting, aside from finding a putter that feels good to you in your hands and looks good to your eye.
He is simply the best, Larry Miller, PGA professional, joining us each and every week right here at SB Nation Radio, the next generation of sports radio, as we go inside the ropes. Always a wonderful conversation. Have a great weekend, Larry. We'll catch up next week, okay?
That was fun. Look forward to it.
Always a true pleasure to catch up with Larry Miller as we are inside the ropes each and every week right here at SB Nation Radio, the big...